Biden, this is The Connection. Colin Powell brings an air of command, to put it mildly, to George W. Bush's foreign policy team. But then what, is the question this hour. Powell will be the first four-star general in the Secretary of State's office since George Marshall in the Truman years after World War II. Marshall gave the world the Marshall Plan for the rebuilding of Europe. Powell, even before he enters the office, is credited with the Powell Doctrine, which says roughly, beware of international forces that the U.S. doesn't dominate entirely, like the U.N. efforts in the Balkans. Don't get into fights where you can't see your way out in victory. And when you do get in, use overwhelming force to win, as in the Gulf War, when Powell was the first President Bush's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. A lot of other symbolism clings to Colin Powell as the first African-American in his job with Jamaican roots, the shipping clerk's kid from the Bronx who might have been a Republican candidate for president 4 years ago or this year. But we're focusing this hour on the real and symbolic clues to his and the Bush team's plans for the solo superpower, for the globe and the global economy. Our guests this hour are the former ambassador to the Soviet Union under Presidents Reagan and Bush, Jack Matlock, now at Princeton, and in our studio in Boston, the MIT military analyst, Barry Posen. Give him a call at 1-800-423-8255. Or join us online at theconnection.org. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Matlock, I wish you'd get us started. You know these players. You played with them, alongside them in the Cold War. Set them up for us now in the post-Cold War world. Not only Colin Powell, but Condoleezza Rice, too.
Well, both of them, I think, are not only very experienced and very intelligent, but very balanced. Foreign policy specialists. I think that one would be doing Powell something of a disservice to consider him strictly a military man. He has extensive political experience in foreign affairs. He was deputy national security advisor and then national security advisor before he became chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He showed there, I think, excellent political instincts and also excellent judgment in foreign affairs issues. Condoleezza Rice is a specialist initially on the communist system and the Russian military and other Warsaw Pact military establishments, but then she worked in the National Security Council. She was very active, for example, in forming policy that led to the unification of Germany and the negotiations with Gorbachev over that issue. She also, of course, has a distinguished academic career. She was provost at Stanford University, and I've heard nothing but praise for her work there, which is, of course, a very trying job to be the number two at a major university. I think she has great managerial skills and interpersonal skills. So I think President-elect Bush has named a first-rate team of great competence.
What do they want to do in the world?
Well, I think that obviously they're going to have to decide that in concrete terms after they get in office, assemble their staffs, look at the situation since they have been out of office. Obviously, they've been thinking about it, but no one can really formulate the concrete policies until you actually have the power to do so. Clearly, they are not in any sense isolationists. I think both of them have the feel that we have tended to use military force not always appropriately, and that we have to avoid putting ourselves in the position of seeming to be the policemen of the world. And I think their instincts are absolutely correct in that respect. I think also they fully understand the necessity of keeping up our alliances, but at the same time, I believe that they feel that we must avoid trying to settle many of disputes, particularly human rights, simply by the use of force. And I think many Americans are going to agree with that assessment.
Give an example of the kind of human rights problem that they're not going to try to settle with force. I mean, what would they have done in Bosnia, for example?
Well, nobody can say exactly what they would have done, but I believe that they would not have started, say, years before the Kosovo situation reached the tragic climax, or, for example, in Bosnia, with some of the mistakes that were made by the Clinton administration. After all, in Bosnia, when there was the prospect of a settlement that might have worked, with the Vance Owen proposals in 1993, the Clinton administration turned them down. And then, after really hundreds of thousands deaths and mayhem, then we forced people to come to Dayton and persuade them to do then what we probably could have gotten peacefully earlier. In the case of Kosovo, we started talking about the possibility of bombing 2 years before it happened, at the same time saying we would never use ground troops. Now, the combination of those two, plus the inability diplomatically to bring the Russians into a more positive involvement in that crisis, meant that ultimately we had to bomb, in effect go to war against another country in a way that most of the world saw as illegal because it had no Security Council sanction. So that I think that the strategy that led to these things was faulty. And I think that they understand that. After all, when the Bush administration went to the Gulf War, they were very careful with their diplomacy. They got the Security Council approval. They even got a Russian quasi-backing in voting with us on the Security Council, none of which we did in the case either of Bosnia or particularly in the Kosovo situation.
Jack Madlock, you're talking about sort of correcting the Clinton administration misjudgments on the Balkans, for example. But what about the Bush 1 miscalculations? Not only was the Powell notion that we do deserts but not mountains, but James Baker's famous line that we didn't have a dog in that fight. Is this Bush 1 all over again, and is it sort of... unrepentant Bush 1?
No, I don't think it's Bush 1 all over again, and obviously I can't predict precisely how this team is going to come down on these issues when they, you know, look over all the facts and so on. But the world has changed, and I think that both Powell and Rice, as well as the president-elect, understand that very well. So the idea that this is somehow, because some of the people are the same, is going to be a repeat of the previous Bush administration, I think is simply not true. After all, when Truman named General Marshall, he produced the Marshall Plan, whereas his experience up to then had been masterminding winning World War II. Quite different task, and he was capable of doing it. So that I don't think there should be any perception that these are people who are so... you might say so rigid that they think the world is the same as it was before.
Jack Matlock, stand by. I want to introduce Barry Posen of MIT. Barry, put this new team, set them in the framework of, it's actually a number of sort of doctrines and Republican styles from Nixon to Reagan to Bush in this whole sort of Vietnam and post-Vietnam period. Where do you put General Powell and Condoleezza Rice in their thinking?
Well, I think these people are broadly realist. I think they have a great respect.
Is that capital R or lowercase r?
A little of both. They're very interested in the great powers in the world and stable, peaceful relations among the great powers. They're very interested in maintaining American power, maybe even expanding it, maybe even ensuring that it not only is number one but remains number one and is perceived to be growing in its number oneness. So all of that is, I think, quite traditional. I mean, it would, you know, none of it would be, you know, surprising or problematical for a Henry Kissinger or a Richard Nixon. You do see in the speeches that President-elect Bush gave a lot of allusions to Ronald Reagan's kind of rhetoric, discussions of freedom and free markets, and. They seem,
that was something quite other than realism, though.
Romanticism. No, this is the other side of it. I talked about the realist strains. Now we're talking about, if you will, I don't want to use the term more romantic strains, but the more idealistic strains. So there's a lot of, that you do see a lot of that kind of rhetoric, but as you move from the rhetoric to the practical matters, at least judging from the texts, these folk are much more interested in free markets and in opening free markets than they are interested in some theory about how they're going to spread democracy. I think their notion seems to be that if the world is at peace and if markets are open, then democracy will come. And that's not necessarily a wrong hypothesis. It's a somewhat different hypothesis from the Clinton administration, which seemed to believe, at least in rhetoric, that you could push that process along.
Tom Friedman raises exactly that question, though, in his New York Times column today, which I found sort of interesting. General Colin Powell is known sort of above all for as a kind of extremely cautious interventionist or non-interventionist. Friedman says the game in the world today is the global economy. Would you intervene? Is it part of the Colin Powell doctrine or the Bush 2 doctrine to intervene when to bail out Mexico, for example, an entirely economic crisis?
You're now beyond my foreign policy security brief. I think I saw the column this morning, and I think it's a good question. If I had to guess, they'll be more flexible about that than their rhetoric implied.
What would they do?
I think they'd find a way. I think given George Bush's own discussions of the importance of Mexico and Canada, it seems unlikely to me that they would just sit there and let the Mexican economy go down the tubes if they could find a way to do a financial bailout. They understand that Mexico is one of the few places in the world where this argument about, crimes, drugs, financial instability, human rights, and all the rest becoming some sort of direct threat to the Americans actually makes some obvious sense. And I just don't think that any Republican or Democratic administration can just sort of sit there and watch, Mexico go into, some sort of a financial or political death spiral without trying to do something.
What about Africa?
I mean, that's the polar opposite of the world, and you find very few discussions of Africa in Bush administration or Bush policy advisor writings or in Bush speeches. Obviously, they make a bow in that direction. It's so obvious when you don't, but it doesn't come up much. And there's a number of issues of violence in Africa today that have a high salience in the media. I mean, Sierra Leone, the Congo, Sudan. There's obviously some problems coming in Zimbabwe. These are issues, they're bloody, they're horrible, they're complicated. They need probably some military power to try and settle them, but whose military power, why, for how long, how? These are all the tough questions. And the general answer that you've gotten in their discourse is, not us, not nation building, not now, not ever. But they don't have – you haven't seen an argument, right? They're going to be faced with a political argument. There's a very well-articulated, well-developed system in the world now that tries to draw the United States of America into these affairs. And if you're not going to go to these affairs, you're going to need to stand up and brawl politically and debate about why you're not going into these affairs. And just saying, not us, not for the American military, not now, not nation building, it sounds good when there's no nasty pictures on TV. But when you have a lot of nasty pictures on TV, human rights organizations, going on McNeil Lehrer, aid organizations in the field talking about the horror show that's there, international media, allies, everyone else saying, to these policy makers, how can you be the world leader and turn your face away from this? If your intention is to turn your face away from it, you need a better argument than they've developed so far.
Well, you've identified Nixon-Kissinger Cold War realism and a kind of Reagan idealistic or romantic anti-communism. George Bush Sr. got tagged with a kind of cautionism. Is that the inheritance of the new Bush administration?
Again,
and
I think
sort of not us, not now, no casualties.
Well, I think
no
you
nation
want to
building.
Well, I think you would be careful about how far you extend that. I think caution is their watchword. I think an interest in power is their watchword, in great powers is their watchword. Interests that have some, where you can make some sort of clear and easy argument. In other words, you're not going to get a lot of debate in the United States of America. Would it be a bad thing if either Iraq or Iran dominated most of the oil in the Persian Gulf? This is not a difficult argument to make. Right? You can wage a war for that, and you can, real estate's going to change hands, so you can have a definite definite beginning and a definite end. It's the kind of war that's comfortable for them in every respect, politically and militarily. The Balkans of this, you know, wars are tougher. Africa wars are tougher yet. It gets less and less clear, right? So one kind of war, I think, you know, they can deal with in a way that's both intellectually and militarily comfortable and politically comfortable, right? The other kind, I think they would have a real problem with. I think they themselves are chary of such wars. I think they understand that the American people, if those wars go awry, will be chary of those wars. I personally agree with them that they should be chary of those wars. I'm not a great supporter of intervention in those wars, but I have been struck by the disjunction between their general rhetoric, where they say they don't want to do these things, and any specific argumentation about the why and the how of how these matters should be treated internationally. I mean, you just sort of turn your head away and let it burn, as it were, and say if somebody else wants to pick up the ball, fine. If they don't, they don't. Or do you develop some sort of, you know, cleverer, more nuanced kind of way of approaching these things? The only thing that you've seen from them that indicates that is these occasional allusions to the East Timor model and somehow the Australians did it. Well, East Timor is small. Australia had an interest. Australia is a competent military power. It's proximate. With a little help from its friends, they can get into a place like that. But, you know, you go a little farther north into Indonesia, into Aceh, and places like that, where Indonesia seems to be on the verge of some sort of chaos that, you know, you can barely understand. But there's a lot of significant internal conflict in Indonesia, right? And that conflict would be difficult and complicated and costly to manage. And the idea that the Australians are going to do it just isn't going to wash in a place like this.
Barry Posen, stand by. Gary Schmidt joins us by phone from Washington. He runs the so-called Project for the New American Century. He worked on Ronald Reagan's national security team. Gary Schmidt, evaluate the sort of the body language, the direction of Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice.
Oh, I think Professor Posen and Ambassador Matlock have aptly described their general views, which I think is, they'll try to focus on sort of the great power issues, and they generally will be reluctant to get down into the dirty messes that seem to define much of what we're concerned with in the last few years. The real question, though, is whether, in fact, they'll, as Professor Posen points out, whether, in fact, they'll be able to avoid those things. And I think one of the ironies is, if I had to describe things, I'd say that the Clinton administration was always reluctant to get into these matters for reasons that, for either domestic reasons or because I think President Clinton never really felt comfortable with foreign policy in general. And I think the Powell Rice team will be reluctant for I think more serious reasons, but nevertheless they will be reluctant, and I think, like the Clinton administration, they will eventually be forced into taking actions because our allies demand it and our own domestic scene will demand it. So
give an example of a kind of an area where they'd rather not be, but will get drawn in.
Oh, I think the Balkans is a perfect example. There's a situation where I think if we had acted more quickly early on and more decisively, the situation might not have gotten out of hand either in Bosnia or in Kosovo. I think that's the kind of lesson that they will have to learn, that, in fact, Powell's doctrine, which seems to suggest the military ought to be the last step, in fact, diplomacy works best when, in fact, the military option is put up on the table much more quickly, and it's done with a real intent of using it, unlike a lot of times with the Clinton administration, which seemed to suggest we're going to use the military, but in fact kept bluffing and bluffing until the point where nobody actually believed it. So I think that lesson they'll learn that fairly quickly, and I think they'll have to trim their realism to match, I think, in fact, the world situation.
Yeah, I think their attitudes about Bosnia and Kosovo are contradictory in a